Ivy was silent for a minute, deciding on her fee, Tenar thought. Instead, she answered the question. I would not take her, she said. Why? I'd be afraid to, the witch answered with a sudden fierce stare at Tenar. Afraid? Of what? Of her. What is she? A child. An ill-used child. That's not all she is. Dark anger came into Tenar, and she said, Must a apprentice witch be a virgin, then? Ivy stared, she said after a moment. I didn't mean that. What did you mean? I mean I don't know what she is. I mean when she looks at me with that one eye seeing and one eye blind, I don't know what she sees. I see you go about with her like she was any child, and I think, what are they? What's the strength of that woman, for she's not a fool, to hold a fire by the hand, to spin thread with the whirlwind? They say, mistress, that you lived as a child yourself with the old ones, the dark ones, the ones underfoot, and that you were queen and servant of those powers. Maybe that's why you're not afraid of this one. What power she is, I don't know, I don't say. But it's beyond my teaching, I know that. Or Beach's, or any witch or wizard I ever knew. I'll give you my advice, mistress, free and feeless. It's this. Beware. Beware her the day she finds her strength. That's all. I thank you, Mistress Ivy, Tenar said, with all the formality of the priestess of the tombs of Atuan, and went out of the warm room into the thin, biting wind of the end of autumn. She was still angry. Nobody would help her, she thought. She knew the job was beyond her. They didn't have to tell her that. But none of them would help her. Ogeon had died, and old Moss ranted, and Ivy warned, and Beach kept clear. And Ged, the one who might really have helped, Ged ran away. Ran off like a whipped dog, and never sent sign or word to her, never gave a thought to her or Tharu, but only to his own precious shame. That was his child, his nursling. That was all he cared about. He had never cared or thought about her, only about power. Her power, his power, how he could use it, how he could make more power of it. Putting the broken ring together, making the rune, putting a king on the throne. And when his power was gone, still it was all he could think about, that it was gone, lost, leaving him only himself, his shame, his emptiness. You aren't being fair, Goha said to Tenar. Fair, said Tenar. Did he play fair? Yes, said Goha. He did. Or tried to. Well, then, he can play fair with the goats he's herding. It's nothing to me, said Tenar, trudging homeward in the wind and the first sparse cold rain. Snow tonight, maybe, said her tenant Tiff, meeting her on the road beside the meadows of the Kahida. Snow so soon? I hope not. Freeze, anyway, for sure. And it froze when the sun was down, rain puddles and watering troughs skimming over, then opaqued with ice. The reeds by the Kahida stilled, bound in ice. The wind itself stilled, as if frozen, unable to move. Beside the fire, a sweeter fire than Ivy's, for the wood was that of an old apple that had been taken down in the orchard last spring. Tenar and Tharu sat to spin and talk after supper was cleared away.
Tell the story about the cat ghosts, Tharu said in her husky voice, as she started the wheel to spin a mass of dark, silky goat's wool into fleece-fell yarn. That's a summer story, Tharu cocked her head. In winter, the stories should be the great stories. In winter, you learn the creation of Ea, so that you can sing it at the long dance when summer comes. In winter, you learn the winter carol and the deed of the young king. And at the festival of sun return, when the sun turns north to bring the spring, you can sing them. I can't sing, the girl whispered. Tenar was winding spun yarn off the distaff into a ball, her hands deft and rhythmic. Not only the voice sings, she said, the mind sings. The prettiest voice in the world's no good if the mind doesn't know the songs. She untied the last bit of yarn, which had been the first spun. You have strength, Tharu, and strength that is ignorant is dangerous. Like the ones who wouldn't learn, Tharu said. The wild ones? Tenar did not know what she meant, and looked her question. The ones that stayed in the west, Tharu said. Ah, the dragons, in the song of the woman of Kimei.
Yes, exactly.
So, which will we start with? How the islands were raised from the sea, or how King Morid drove back the black ships?
The islands, Tharu whispered. Tenar had rather hoped she would choose the deed of the young king, for she saw Lebanon's face as Morid's. But the child's choice was the right one.
Very well, she said. She glanced up at Ogeon's great lore books on the mantel, encouraging herself that if she forgot, she could find the words there, and drew breath and began. By her bedtime, Tharu knew how Sigoi had raised the first of the islands from the depths of time. Instead of singing to her, Tenar sat on the bed after tucking her in, and they recited together, softly, the first stanza of the Song of the Making. Tenar carried the little oil lamp back to the kitchen, listening to the absolute silence. The frost had bound the world, locked it. No star showed. Blackness pressed at the single window of the kitchen. Cold lay on the stone floors. She went back to the fire, for she was not sleepy yet. The great words of the song had stirred her spirit, and there was still anger and unrest in her from her talk with Ivy. She took the poker to rouse up a little flame from the backlog. As she struck the log, there was an echo of the sound in the back of the house. She straightened up and stood listening. Again, a soft, dull thump or thud outside the house, at the dairy window. The poker still in her hand, Tenar went down the dark hall to the door that gave on the cool room. Beyond the cool room was the dairy. The house was built against a low hill, and both those rooms ran back into the hill like cellars, though on a level with the rest of the house. The cool room had only air vents. The dairy had a door and a window, low and wide like the kitchen window, in its one outside wall. Standing at the cool room door, she could hear that window being pried or jimmied, and men's voices whispering. Flint had been a methodical householder. Every door but one of his house had a bar bolt on each side of it, a stout length of cast iron set in slides. All were kept clean and oiled. None were ever locked. She slipped the bolt across the cool room door. It slid into place without a sound, fitting snug into the heavy iron slot on the door jamb. She heard the outer door of the dairy opened. One of them had finally thought to try it before they broke the window and found it wasn't locked. She heard the mutter of voices again, then silence, long enough that she heard her heartbeat drumming in her ears so loud she feared she could not hear any sound over it. She felt her legs trembling, and felt the cold of the floor creep up under her skirt like a hand. "It's open," a man's voice whispered near her, and her heart leapt painfully. She put her hand on the bolt, thinking it was open. She had unlocked, not locked it. She had almost slid it back when she heard the door between the cool room and the dairy creak, opening. She knew that creak of the upper hinge. She knew the voice that had spoken, too, but in a different way of knowing. "It's a storeroom," Andy said. And then, as the door she stood against rattled against the bolt, "This one's locked." It rattled again. A thin blade of light, like a knife blade, flicked between the door and the jamb. It touched her breast, and she drew back as if it had cut her. The door rattled again, but not much. It was solid, solidly hinged, and the bolt was firm. They muttered together on the other side of the door. She knew they were planning to come around and try the front of the house. She found herself at the front door, bolting it, not knowing how she came there. Maybe this was a nightmare. She had had this dream, that they were trying to get into the house, that they drove thin knives through the cracks of the doors. The doors, was there any other door they could get in? The windows, the shutters of the bedroom windows. Her breath came so short she thought she could not get to Tharu's room, but she was there. She brought the heavy wooden shutters across the glass. The hinges were stiff, and they came together with a bang. Now they knew. Now they were coming. They would come to the window of the next room, her room. They would be there before she could close the shutters. And they were. She saw the faces,
blurs moving in the darkness outside, as she tried to free the left-hand shutter from its hasp. It was stuck. She could not make it move. A hand touched the glass, flattening white against it.
There she is. Let us in. We won't hurt you. We just want to talk to you. He just wants to see his little girl.
She got the shutter free and dragged it across the window. But if they broke the glass, they would be able to push the shutters open from the outside. The fastening was only a hook that would pull out of the wood if forced.
Let us in and we won't hurt you, one of the voices said.
She heard their feet on the frozen ground, crackling in the fallen leaves. Was Theroux awake? The crash of the shutters closing might have wakened her, but she had made no sound. Tenar stood in the doorway between her room and Theroux's. It was pitch dark, silent. She was afraid to touch the child and waken her. She must stay in the room with her. She must fight for her. She had had the poker in her hand. Where had she put it? She had put it down to close the shutters. She could not find it. She groped for it in the blackness of the room that seemed to have no walls. The front door, which led into the kitchen, rattled, shaken in its frame. If she could find the poker, she would stay in here. She would fight them. Here, one of them called, and she knew what he had found. He was looking up at the kitchen window, broad, unshuttered, easy to reach. She went, very slowly it seemed, groping, to the door of the room. It was Theroux's room now. It had been her children's room, the nursery. That was why there was no lock on the inner side of the door, so the children could not lock themselves in and be frightened if the bolt stuck. Around back of the hill, through the orchard, Clearbrook and Shandy would be asleep in their cottage. If she called, maybe Shandy would hear. If she opened the bedroom window and called, or if she waked Theroux and they climbed out the window and ran through the orchard, but the men were there, right there, waiting. It was more than she could bear. The frozen terror that had bound her broke, and in rage, she ran into the kitchen, that was all red light in her eyes, grabbed up the long, sharp butcher knife from the block, flung back the door bolt, and stood in the doorway. "Come on, then," she said. As she spoke, there was a howl and a sucking gasp, and a man yelled, "Look out!" Another shouted, "Here, here!" Then there was silence. Light from the open doorway shot across the black ice of puddles, glittered on the black branches of the oaks and on fallen silver leaves. And as her eyes cleared, she saw that something was crawling towards her on the path, a dark mass or heap crawling towards her, making a high, sobbing wail. Behind the light, a black shape ran and darted, and long blades shone.
"Tenar!"
"Stop there," she said, raising the knife.
"Tenar, it's me, Hawk, Sparrowhawk."
"Stay there," she said. The darting black shape stood still next to the black mass lying on the path. The light from the doorway shone dim on a body, a face, a long-tined pitchfork held upright.
"Like a wizard's staff," she thought.
"Is that you?" she said. He was kneeling now by the black thing on the path.
"I killed him, I think," he said.
He looked over his shoulder, stood up. There was no sign or sound of the other men.
"Where are they?"
"Ran. Give me a hand, Tenar." She held the knife in one hand. With the other, she took hold of the arm of the man that lay huddled up on the path. Ged took him under the shoulder, and they dragged him up the step and into the house. He lay on the stone floor of the kitchen, and blood ran out of his chest and belly like water from a pitcher. His upper lip was drawn back from his teeth, and only the whites of his eyes showed. "Lock the door," Ged said, and she locked the door.
"Linen's in the press," she said,
and he got a sheet and tore it for bandages, which she bound round and round the man's belly and breast, into which three of the four tines of the pitchfork had driven full force, making three ragged springs of blood that dripped and squirted as Ged supported the man's torso so that she could wrap the bandages.
"What are you doing here? Did you come with them?"
"Yes, but they didn't know it. That's about all you can do, Tenar." He let the man's body sag down and sat back, breathing hard, wiping his face with the back of his bloody hand.
"I think I killed him," he said again.
"Maybe you did." Tenar watched the bright red spots spread slowly on the heavy linen that wrapped the man's thin, hairy chest and belly. She stood up and swayed, very dizzy. "Get by the fire," she said. "You must be perishing." She did not know how she had known him in the dark outside, by his voice, maybe. He wore a bulky shepherd's winter coat of cut fleece with the leather side out, and a shepherd's knit watch cap pulled down. His face was lined and weathered, his hair long and iron-gray. He smelled like wood smoke and frost and sheep. He was shivering, his whole body shaking. "Get by the fire," she said again. "Put wood on it." He did so. Tenar filled the kettle and swung it out on its iron arm over the blaze. There was blood on her skirt, and she used an end of linen soaked in cold water to clean it. She gave the cloth to Ged to clean the blood off his hands. "What do you mean?" she said. "You came with them, but they didn't know it." "I was coming down from the mountain, on the road from the springs of the Cahida." He spoke in a flat voice, as if out of breath, and his shivering made his speech slur. "Heard men behind me, and I went aside, into the woods. Didn't feel like talking. I don't know. Something about them. I was afraid of them." She nodded impatiently and sat down across the hearth from him, leaning forward to listen, her hands clenched tight in her lap. Her damp skirt was cold against her legs. "I heard one of them say, 'Oak Farm,' as they went by. After that, I followed them. One of them kept talking about the child." "What did he say?" He was silent. He said finally, "That he was going to get her back. Punish her," he said. "And get back at you for stealing her," he said. "He said..." He stopped. "That he'd punish me, too?" "They all talked about that." "That one isn't handy," she nodded toward the man on the floor. "Is it the..." "He said she was his." Ged looked at the man, too, and back at the fire. "He's dying. We should get help." "He won't die," Tenar said. "I'll send for Ivy in the morning. The others are still out there. How many of them?" "Two. If he dies, he dies. If he lives, he lives. Neither of us are going out." She got to her feet in a spasm of fear. "Did you bring in the pitchfork, Ged?" He pointed to it, the four long tines shining as it leaned against the wall beside the door. She sat down in the hearth seat again, but now she was shaking, trembling from head to foot, as he had done. He reached across the hearth to touch her arm. "It's all right," he said. "What if they're still out there?" "They ran. They could come back. Two against two, and we've got the pitchfork." She lowered her voice to a bare whisper to say, in terror, "The pruning hook and the scythes are in the barn lean-to." He shook his head. "They ran. They saw him and you in the door." "What did you do?" "He came at me, so I came at him. I mean before, on the road. They got cold walking. It started to rain, and they got cold and started talking about coming here. Before that, it was only this one talking about the child and you, about teaching lessons." His voice dried up. "I'm thirsty," he said. "So am I. The kettle's not boiling yet. Go on." He took breath and tried to tell his story coherently. "The other two didn't listen to him much. Heard it all before, maybe. They were in a hurry to get on, to get to Valmouth, as if they were running from somebody, getting away. But it got cold, and he went on about Oak Farm, and the one with the cap said, 'Well, why not just go there and spend the night with the widow?' Yes." Ged put his face in his hands. She waited. He looked into the fire and went on steadily. "Then I lost them for a while. The road came out level into the valley, and I couldn't follow along the way I'd been doing, in the woods, just behind them. I had to go aside, through the fields, keeping out of their sight. I don't know the country here, only the road. I was afraid if I cut across the fields, I'd get lost, miss the house. And it was getting dark. I thought I'd missed the house, overshot it. I came back to the road and almost ran into them at the turn there. They'd seen the old man go by. They decided to wait till it was dark, and they were sure nobody else was coming. They waited in the barn. I stayed outside, just through the wall from them. "You must be frozen," Tenar said dully. "It was cold." He held his hands to the fire, as if the thought of it had chilled him again. I found the pitchfork by the lean-to door. They went around to the back of the house when they came out. I could have come to the front door then to warn you. It's what I should have done. But all I could think of was to take them by surprise. I thought it was my only advantage, chance. I thought the house would be locked, and they'd have to break in. But then I heard them going in at the back there. I went in into the dairy after them. I only just got out when they came to the locked door.